Rodgers in trouble. It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Welcome to the Glass Half Empty podcast on the Big Lead. I'm Ryan Glasspiegel. This podcast is produced by Michael Schamberger. Our guest today is Rachel Nichols, who doesn't need much of an introduction. She hosts The Jump on ESPN. Rachel, how's everything going?
Not bad. How are you? Can I start with a question to you? Is that unconventional or against the rules?
Go for it.
How did you decide glass half empty versus glass half full?
We had commenters and they suggested the name for it before. We taped a podcast with like Kenny Smith and we taped one with Dan Lebatard, and I don't think we had a title for it when we began it. The commenters suggested glass half empty. I think I'd probably change it now if we didn't have to deal with like 45 different hoops with changing the title. We're stuck with it.
Will you feel you are a glass half full person, though, living in a glass half empty podcast?
Sure. It depends on the content.
Okay.
So let's get to the NBA talk. Right now, it's November 21st. We'll be publishing this on the 22nd. Who would you pick to win the East, the Cavs or the Celtics or the field?
I mean, you know, the nice thing is you don't have to pick on November 21st or 22nd who's going to win the East, but I'm not saying that to get out or make a prediction. I just don't really believe in predictions because, first of all, they're usually not right. And even when they are right, then they're no fun. My thing on sports is that the unpredictability is really the reason why we watch it. It is fun to see a great team do great and have the outcome you expect when you go to a game, but the stuff that really thrills us is when your jaw drops and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe he did that. Or I can't believe they came back like that. Or I can't believe they won that. And it's a surprise. And that's the thing that I think is so great about the NBA. There's so many stories every week where you're just sort of slack-jawed at, oh my God, I can't believe that happened. So I try not to take out of sports and take out of the league the thing that I like best about the league.
How do you think the Cavs' fortunes are going to change when Isaiah Thomas returns? Not asking you to make a prediction, but how do you think it's
changed? No. Analysis is fine. I always kind of talk about it like movies, right? That like when you're a kid and you went to go see a Harry Potter movie, you might not know what's going to happen in the movie, but you know Harry Potter's going to win, right? I mean,
well, if you read the
books, when you go watch, right? Well, you know the basic sort of outcome of what's going to happen. When you go to a sporting event, you don't know which team is Harry Potter, right? And which team cannot be named. So I think that's sort of the fun. But analysis, I'm all in on. And yeah, I mean, there's no question that I think the Cavs will improve offensively when Isaiah comes back. I mean, the big question is you don't know what Isaiah is going to be like when he comes back. He might be one thing when he comes back in the middle of the season, whenever that is. And then another thing by the time he gets to the end of the season, he might be right out of the box, what we saw in Boston. He is going to give them a tremendous amount more offensive flexibility. He should complement LeBron really well because LeBron, with the way he plays right now, does well. The more shooters there are with him on the court, the Cavs, as we tape this podcast, have won 5 in a row, and that is partly because due to the injuries that they have had and the guys they've had to have on the bench necessarily, they've now put on the court more shooters around LeBron. So I think all of that will be great. We know that Isaiah is more of a liability defensively. But Kyrie, when he played for the Cavs, was more of a liability defensively, too. And they found that his offense just covered up for some of the defense because teams weren't running in transition on them as much because the Cavs were actually scoring baskets. So teams would have to, you know, come back, throw back in, and that would obviously change the way the Cavaliers were able to set up defensively. If they are able to get more of that back with Isaiah when he comes on the court, that should help them. We'll just have to see.
It's been pretty surprising how well the Celtics have performed. I mean, everybody thought that they would be in certainly the top half of the conference, but then when Gordon Hayward went down, it's shocking that they're on this winning streak, right?
I mean, look, I said on TV the day after Gordon Hayward went down that I thought the Celtics were going to be fine. I did not think that they were going to win 16 in a row, but I thought they were going to be still a real team to contend with because the guys who were left on that team were impressive. Kyrie Irving, obviously, as we've seen, has just, you know, been a rock star. And then, you know, the young players on that team have such a good sense of themselves. And the spirit on that team, too. And you saw it in that first game against the Cavaliers. You know, Gordon goes down, and everyone in the arena is just, you know, horrified. And you could see the Celtics were just ripped apart emotionally. It took so long for them to get themselves back together. They fell behind by double digits in that game. And yet, even within that game, you could see it. They started to pick themselves back up off the floor. They came back. It was really only because LeBron sort of did some of his LeBron heroics at the end of the game that they were able to, the Cavaliers were still able to win that game. You could see it in that first night, the fight that the Celtics were going to have. And I'm certainly was never expecting them to reel off this winning streak. I don't think the team themselves was expecting to reel off this winning streak, but I did expect them to, you know, sort of show the guts that they have shown. And I think they're going to contend all the way to the end.
Not asking you to get into the prediction business, but it seems really hard to believe that really anybody could beat the Warriors, provided that Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, Draymond Green, and Klay Thompson have functional limbs come May and June.
you know, the Warriors are so much fun. Not just because they win, but sort of the way they play basketball is so much fun to watch. You've got, as you say, generational talents all collected on that team. I was in college in Chicago when the Chicago Bulls were churning out their dynasty championships. When I was a college intern and a stringer, I got to go cover the Bulls and sort of watch that dynasty up close and enjoyed it so much. So it's fun seeing sort of this version of it and getting to compare and getting to have Scottie Pippen next to me on the jump as we talk about the Warriors. And, it's one of those things where you say, provided that. That's, again, you know, one of those things that's great about the NBA, provided that Steph Curry doesn't slip on a pile of sweat unexpectedly the way he did, provided that Draymond Green doesn't get suspected unexpectedly the way he did. I mean, things happen in the NBA. Kevin Durant had an injury last year where they said it really, you know, 1 millimeter difference, he would have broken his leg and been out the entire year. Instead, it turned out to be a bad sprain, and he came back and was able to play in the playoffs. So we just don't know. And I think that NBA fans and basketball fans should enjoy it when the Warriors are whole and not injured, because this team is so much fun to watch.
From an analytical perspective, again, not a predictive perspective, who do you think is better situated right now to win the Eastern Conference or compete for a title in the next three seasons, the Bucks or the 76ers?
I mean, gosh, you've got the Bucks, you've got the 76ers, you've got the Celtics, who, don't forget, still have a pack of draft picks that they can either spend in the draft, in these next couple great drafts, or that they can trade for parts.
Even the Knicks?
I think what's exciting is that the Knicks, here you go, look, I mean, hey, are you a Knicks fan?
No, I'm a Bucks fan.
Okay. certainly the Knicks are an exciting young team, too, although they need to have a few more parts around Porzingis. You know, I think that the East has turned out to be certainly more competitive this year than a lot of people predicted, again, after that Gordon Hayward injury, but even beforehand. And certainly the more promising teams, the, quote, teams of the future, are in the East. I love what the Sixers have because I just think that both Simmons and Embiid are sort of those generational talents like we talk about. I think Simmons is just, you can see it, he's practically locked up Rookie of the Year, and it's only November, and Embiid is just, if he can stay healthy, and that is, of course, the qualifier with him, can do things on a basketball court we just haven't seen from someone his size. So I love the way they're positioned for the future. I don't know if it's going to play out that way because, again, unexpected things happen, so we'll have to see how it goes.
Bledsoe's really transformed the Bucks. It seemed a little bit before he got there, like Jason Kidd was maybe kind of sort of starting to check out. We've seen that happen with him in past spots in his career as a player and coach, but they feel reinvigorated. Bledsoe's all over the place on defense, stealing the ball, and he can throw an alley oop 75 feet in the air, and Giannis is going to catch it and finish it.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think he came to that team with a lot to prove. I think after being in Phoenix and certainly the way he left Phoenix with all of the friction there, I think he wants to show he's. I'm sorry?
He got misinterpreted. He didn't want to be at a hair salon.
Exactly. I personally, as our friend Brian Windhorst said, it was the best $10,000 he ever spent. If that got him, even though it got him fined, it got him out of Phoenix. And I personally think he should have done it much sooner, hair salon or no. But yeah, I think he has a lot to prove, and he wants to show people, and he's sort of playing to his max potential and with max effort, and that rubs off on the other guys. And also, frankly, just, you know, the dimensions he has as a player change the way that they can play. The Bucks can be in transition. They can run more, and that's so important when you have someone like Giannis. His advantage is so huge. I mean, he takes, what, 4 steps, and he's from the midcourt line all the way to the basket. So when you have that, and then you have a player that allows your player to unlock that part of his game, that's a huge win. That is one of those 1+1 makes 3 situations, not 1+1 makes 2. And it's so fun to see.
Switching gears to kind of a general question about the way you prep for the show. On some nights of the NBA, there's 10, 12 games. There are any number of different situations happening on social media with all the players and their personalities. There's a zillion reporters covering the league, both inside ESPN and outside. And then there are all of these stats to keep track of, both normal standard stats like points, rebounds, assists, plus minus, and then advanced stats as well. How do you distill all of that into 24 minutes of content for the Jump? And then from there, how do you pick the most important topic for your monologue?
Well, I think one important thing to sort of our approach to the show is we are not trying to be sort of the daily summary or daily sort of encyclopedia of the NBA. You know, I often say to people, hey, we're just not going to get in anything, everything. So trying to get in everything doesn't feel like a smart goal because you're always going to fail. And also then you're kind of never giving anything a lot of attention. You're just giving everything a little bit of attention. And that's not really what we want to do. So I think a lot of it is just preference, sort of what catches our staff's attention, what catches my attention. I think the NBA, because it is so communal and has such a great sort of social media community, it's not just sort of everyone throwing off one-liners, but there's great sort of collaboration and sort of interplay between all the characters of NBA Twitter. You can have a good sense of sort of what things are cresting and what things are kind of on people's minds. You have a reporting core around the NBA that's very in touch with each other and sort of working off of each other. So if someone on the Thunder beat has something where a player says something about what just happened with the Knicks and the trade and Melo, you know, the Knicks reporters pick that up pretty quickly and then they go and talk to their guys. And I mean, it's one of those things where you can see how things kind of come and crashes in a wave. As for the monologue, that's something that just sort of, you know, each night kind of after going through the night's game, sometimes it'll be particular to a game. You know, I work out of L.A., Joel Embiid here in L.A., 3-day run where he played, you know, against the Lakers and the Clippers and had a transcendent performance against the Lakers and really crossed sort of a line in what he sort of proved to himself that he could be. And it was very obvious after that night, hey, we're talking about Joel Embiid at the top of the show. Sometimes it's more of, you know, a topic, you know, something that's been brewing in terms of an issue in the NBA, and it has nothing to do with the night's action. And sometimes it's just something I feel really passionate about. It's one of the nice things about being a host and being the one who's on the show every day. I can kind of put forth my viewpoint and put it forth first and then open it up for discussion because everyone always has something to say.
You've got a lot of cordial relationships with a lot of the players, specifically LeBron. But I'm wondering, how do you maintain those relationships with them but still – journalistically, when you have to critique somebody's performance or his behavior, how do you draw a line with that type of dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned to you that I started covering NBA games when I was a college stringer, right, and a college intern. So I've been covering the league on and off for 20 years. I have relationships with so many people where I literally have covered maybe their first game in the NBA, every important NBA game that they played since then, and then their retirement game. I mean, I did an event with Shaq last week, and we were talking just about how much of his career I was just standing 10 feet away from. So you do develop relationships with those guys over time. And I think the key to covering them and the key to talking to them and the key to talking to fans about them is to just be completely transparent and honest. You know, I think the idea of objectivity has sort of morphed and changed over the years with journalists, especially in sports. And I don't think that the concept of objectivity has changed. I think just sort of how transparent we are about it has changed. We always hear about, right, the reporters who rode the rails with Babe Ruth, and they, like, drank with him and smoked with him and hung out with him. And, you know, reporters today, we don't do that. We don't travel with the teams. We don't do any of that. So you could say we're more objective now. But I think we're a little bit more open about, like, oh, yeah, I've known so-and-so since this point. I've been around him for this and this. Here's what I can tell you from being around him. I think players know that we're going to come with them and that I, in particular, try to come with them, and I'm always really fair. And if they screw up, I'm going to talk to them about screwing up, and that has happened in so many of the interviews I do. You mentioned LeBron. We've talked about times he screwed up in interviews. I will come at him or come at those people with those questions, but they're always in sort of a fair way. I'm not a gotcha interview person. And I think people respect the fact that if you're honest and fair and sort of actually listening to the answers that people give you and not just interested in hearing yourself talk, that they respect that. And you don't have to just be buttering them up. I think people appreciate honesty.
Could you have ever envisioned when you were covering the NBA 20 plus years ago that this social media explosion would happen where we're interpreting memes and subtweets and things of that nature?
Well, see, this goes to me. You can't predict everything. If I had been able to envision this, I would have made a lot of money on Google and Facebook and Twitter, and I wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be doing this pod. You and I would be like on some great, you know, adventure instead. I think it's fun if, well, if I was a fortune future teller, I would lay it out. I think that one thing that's cool about the NBA, while you couldn't have necessarily envisioned this, I think the league has history of sort of embracing whatever cultural trend is going on, and whether that is, you know, social media and the way that the NBA has embraced the internet and social media in a way that, frankly, a lot of other leagues haven't, from the way it lets fans and media outlets share clips and sort of promote, you know, play with things and make them into GIFs and, you know, sort of Photoshop things, and no one's ever going to get sued. And they've been very open about sort of spreading it out and letting people share, as opposed to other leagues that have been like, no, copyright infringement. The NBA has sort of said, no, this is part of the cultural zeitgeist, and we want to be part of it. We want to participate in it. We want new fans exposed to us who might not ever see an NBA highlight if it wasn't in their social media feed. I think the NBA, even before there was social media, embraced culture. And I think you can see that in the clothes and in the language and sort of the reflection of promotional events in 1978 or whatever year you want to pick. And so it doesn't surprise me that the NBA has maintained that in this particular era with this particular thing.
You mentioned the juxtaposition with the NBA and other leagues. A few years ago, when you were at CNN and the NFL was having its domestic violence crisis, you had a couple of pretty tough questions for Roger Goodell. And I'm curious if you see the way that these leagues are respectively headed right now. The NBA has had a 2-year renaissance with all of these bright young stars. The Cavs-Warriors rivalry has helped things a lot. LeBron, as you've said, is a generational talent. The NFL is, for the first time in really 30 years, is experiencing some attrition. It's almost a boulder going down a hill. I'm wondering, do you see the NFL being able to withstand this and stop their attrition? Or could you envision a scenario where in 15 years, the NBA might catch the NFL in revenue?
I mean, look, I think the headlines about the NFL are not necessarily the things that are going to be the thing it wrestles with the most long term.
the concussion issue, which has been around now for quite some time. I mean, it's obviously been around since people were playing in the NFL, but it started to get attention and for quite some time. It's not always the sort of most clickable headline, right? I don't know how you guys work on the big lead in terms of what you put in a headline and you know, whether stories about the Jerry Jones, Roger Goodell feud or, you know, issues going on with the Deflategate or any of the other sort of seasonal issues that the NFL deals with probably get a lot more clicks than a story about concussions. But I do think long-term, the concussion issue is what the NFL is going to have to fight in terms of whether it holds its place as sort of our national pastime and our nation's most popular sport. Because just anecdotally, I have young children and I am now at the age where I have friends who have young kids and the people I know who have boys have said, oh, I want my kid to play flag football, but I want him to play tackle. I'm steering him to baseball, steering him to basketball, steering him to other things. And, you know, right now football gets a lot of buzz from the Friday night lights and it being these football teams being the center of town on a Friday night. And if the high school programs stop being something that are communal and that people want to participate in and our best athletes don't go play football anymore, our best athletes go play soccer and basketball and baseball and all the other available sports, it will eventually reach a level down the line where it affects the NFL and the popularity of the NFL. And to me, that is going to be the long-term question that the National Football League has to face. I know these shorter-term things are going to get attention, and I do think they make little chips and dents into the league's popularity, but I see the concussion issue and the pain management issue and sort of the human cost of playing football to be the thing that may, in the end, determine how popular a league they stay.
Yeah, and right now there's what? Well, being generous, there's 20 watchable quarterbacks in the league. If that number goes from 20 to 8, then it's really hard to believe that there's going to be as much viewership and interest in these games in 20 years.
I mean, you know, it's just, we have seen sports in this country that seemed, you know, unshakable, whether it be boxing or horse racing or things that, you know, you had millions of people hanging on every detail. And those sports time passed, and there's no way for us to know sitting here right now in 2017 if that's going to happen to the NFL in 10 years or 20 years or 40 years or ever, but it would be naive to think it couldn't happen.
But switching back to the NBA, your colleagues, Brian Windhorst and Zach Lowe, had a really interesting piece a month or two ago that there was a memo that something like half of the teams lost money last year, despite the fact that it's really a boom period in the sport and there was a gigantic new television contract. Do you see any, like, how are the big markets and the small markets going to reconcile the disparity in their local TV deals in order to make it so that it's not just a league where the Lakers, Knicks, and a couple other big market teams really dominate it financially for the long term?
I mean, revenue sharing is such an interest. Again, I don't know how clickable headlines it is for the lay fam, but I will say it's such a fascinating topic, right? And each league kind of handles it differently. And we see in, say, baseball and football, the diametric sort of, you know, ways, you know, different leagues handle it differently. You can see the effect it has on sort of big and small markets. You know, it is a question, and this is, again, it's not unique to the NBA. It is in the interest of even the big, rich teams that they have teams to play, right? You can't just have three or four teams in your league. You will not have a successful league. So it is important for teams like the Knicks and Lakers and other teams that make a lot of money to have other viable, functioning teams in the league. So sharing some of your revenue with them is actually in your interest as well. The question becomes, how is that revenue shared? The question is, how is it determined whether you are losing money over something that you should or shouldn't be losing money over? Are you losing money as another franchise because, hey, you just play in a small TV market and you're not going to get as much money for your local TV deal as the guys in LA and New York are? And, you know, that's just the facts of the way the U.S. economy works, and New York and LA got to chip in to make up for that. Or is it a case of X franchise is being, you know, they have kind of a crappy sales team and they don't sell a lot of tickets because they're not doing a very good job marketing, and they have kind of not a very good front office or scouting staff, and they haven't really invested in overseas scouts, or they haven't really invested in an analytics staff because they figure, even if our players don't play well, or we don't do well, or we don't bring in a lot at the gate, we're going to get propped up by the Knicks and Lakers. So those are two very different reasons to need to revenue share, and you can understand why the teams that are dishing out the money might be more in favor of one than the other. It's complicated, though, because that's all objective and subjective, rather. I mean, there's not an objective measure for, you know, how good is your sales ticket staff, you know, ticket sales staff. And I think that that's going to be an issue that sort of is not solvable. I don't think there's going to be some magic way that they fix it. I think it's a constant negotiation for all of these sports leagues on sort of how they work the numbers so that teams that aren't in as fortunate geographic positions can be competitive, but still are incentivized to be self-starters in how they run their organizations.
Yeah, I agree with all that. The last time the NBA owners had this issue within themselves, they were able to band together and get the players to sacrifice a piece of the pie. I don't think they're going to be able to go back to that well. So it's going to be fascinating to see how they handle it amongst themselves going forward.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think we saw with the last collective bargaining agreement in the NBA that both the player and the owner side feel like they've got a good thing going and they don't want to sort of upset the apple cart, and that any major issues either side has, you know, has to be settled in either an amicable way between the two of them or worked out amongst themselves, because I think they know that having a lockout right now would stop the momentum that they've gained as a league. And there wasn't, you know, didn't even really feel like a question of it from the last CBA bargaining. Both sides sort of felt like, great, we want to get a deal done, and if we don't get everything we want, so be it.
Is there anybody connected with the NBA that you haven't interviewed that you think would be really like a fascinating get that you would love to have either on the Jump or as a SportsCenter special or anything like that?
There isn't like some big, you know, white whale out there or anything. I think that one thing that's cool about the NBA is that it's sort of always changing and churning. Yes, you have guys who are stars and are going to be superstars. Kevin Durant's going to be a superstar in this league for a long time. I interviewed him beginning of the season. I don't know, I want to say September maybe. And I'm thrilled to have done it. I interviewed him on the final day of the NBA Finals when he won his MVP, and I'm thrilled to have done it then, and I'm going to be thrilled the next time I sit down with him. But there also is going to be a bunch of people in between that who pop up and who are interesting stories along the way that you wouldn't necessarily expect, and I love those interviews too. My favorite time to interview someone is when they're going through some sort of big change, because I think that's kind of the most interesting time to get someone. So who you want to interview at any given time sort of shifts a little based on sort of what they're going through at that point in their life.
When you're taping the Jump, how much do you think about creating a segment that can on its own become distributable online?
We think about it a lot because I think that, you know, especially with a daytime show that is on when a lot of people are at work, you know, people consume the show in a lot of different ways that aren't just sitting in front of their TV when it's on live, being beamed across the United States. I think that a lot of people see clips online. I think a lot of people see it on demand. I was thrilled to see that the Jump's on-demand numbers are among the best at ESPN, which kind of reflects maybe our audience. We have a young audience that sort of gets its media a lot of different ways. And so we think a lot about how to make things accessible for people getting the Jump on a podcast or in a way that isn't just sitting in front of their TVs at 3:00 Eastern. Because I just don't think that that's the way it works anymore. That's not the way I watch a lot of the stuff I watch. So I certainly wouldn't expect anyone else to.
Is there anything that we didn't talk about either in the NBA or the composition of the Jump that you think is really interesting that you want to discuss right now?
I just think it's fun to, you know, it's one of the things where ESPN was talking about doing a daytime NBA show for a long time. And I'm thrilled that we were able to hit on something with the Jump that not only seems to be working so well and has gotten such a great reception, both sort of inside the league and out, but sort of has been able to capture the feel of the NBA and what it's about. And you asked me before about how you distill down different storylines. The thing I'm probably most proud of is that it's not that we're sort of the newsletter of the NBA where we're hitting, you know, topics A through T or whatever every day, because that's what happened the night before. But I feel like the show has done a really cool job of being able to sort of get the feel of the league on any given day. And that's really a credit to the producers we have We have this amazing team of people who are sort of all over everything all the time, and I think are really reflective of the NBA fans. We have a really young and diverse group of people working on the show, and that lets us have a diversity of ideas and a diversity of thought that I think comes across on TV, and I just think it's the right time for the right show and the right place of the right sport, and the you don't always get that, so the match of that has felt really special.
You mentioned the producers and the diversity of thought. Is there anybody behind the scenes that really makes the jump work that you want to shine a light on right now?
We have such a great crew. I'm going to give you some people, but I don't want to leave anyone out. You know, I talk about them on the show on the air with some frequency because I do think they're such an integral part of what we do. So people who watch the show regularly hear me talk about producer Danny. That's our producer, Danny Corrales, who runs things day to day, just has great flavor and great touch. I think that touch is the thing you can't really teach. You can teach someone to be an NBA fan if they're not a big NBA fan, although Danny is. You can teach someone how to do TV. You can't really teach touch and tone, and he's just got great tone, and I think he set a great table for the show in terms of what the tone of the show is and sort of what the tone for the staff should be, and kind of letting everyone sort of play to their strengths in a way that has been really sharp. And we have this little core group that started. We were a very small staff when we started the show, so whether it's with our coordinating producer, Rochelle Marquezine, or Steve Martinez, who works on our show, Michael Bodmer, who works on our show. We just have this sort of smaller group that started in L.A., and then we've been able to add and add and add people. We now have staff that's also in Bristol, and it's been fun to have sort of this club now that's like, you know, Team Jump. It definitely feels like a little project that we get to do every day, and I think that communal feel comes across on the air.
Thank you very much for your time, Rachel. We really appreciate it. Hopefully we'll get a chance to talk to you again maybe as the playoffs are approaching or getting in the swing of things.
I'd love it.
Thanks again, Rachel. Have a great rest of the week.
Absolutely, Ryan. Thanks so much.
Familiar touch turns strange.